Part 3. Safeguarding Civilization. Chapter 5. Extinction. Space Guard. At 0946 GMT, on the morning of the 11th of September, in the exceptionally beautiful summer of the year 2077, most of the inhabitants of Europe saw a dazzling fireball appear in the eastern sky. Within seconds, it was brighter than the sun, and as it moved across the heavens, at first in utter silence, it left behind it a churning column of dust and smoke. Somewhere above Austria, it began to disintegrate, producing a series of concussions so violent that more than 1 million people had their hearing permanently damaged. They were the lucky ones. Moving at 50 kilometers a second, 1,000 tons of rock and metal impacted on the plains of northern Italy, destroying in a few flaming moments the labor of centuries. The cities of Padua and Verona were wiped from the face of the earth, and the last glories of Venice sank forever beneath the sea as the waters of the Adriatic came, thundering landwards after the hammer blow from space. 600,000 people died, and the total damage was more than $1 trillion. But the loss to art, to history, to science, to the whole human race for the rest of time, was beyond all computation. It was as if a great war had been fought and lost in a single morning, and few could draw much pleasure from the fact that, as the dust of destruction slowly settled, for months the whole world witnessed the most splendid dawns and sunsets since Krakatoa. After the initial shock, mankind reacted with a determination and a unity that no earlier age could have shown. Such a disaster, it was realized, might not occur again for 1,000 years, but it might occur tomorrow. And the next time, the consequences could be even worse. Very well. There would be no next time. Thus begins Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama, a science fiction novel published in 1973. In this story, the government of Earth, shaken by the asteroid strike in Italy, sets up a system called Space Guard, an early warning system for Earth-bound threats from space. For years, many scientists warned of the dangers that asteroids pose to life on Earth, but for many years they weren't listened to, even after it was first proposed in 1980 that the dinosaurs were killed off by a huge asteroid striking the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. There was, in the words of leading astronomer Clark R. Chapman, a giggle factor associated with the risk from asteroids. This all changed in 1994 when comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 thudded into the side of Jupiter with the force of 300 billion tons of TNT, equivalent to 125 times the world's nuclear arsenal. One of the Shoemaker-Levy fragments left a scar on Jupiter 12,000 kilometers across, about the size of Earth. David Levy noted that the comet that he co-discovered killed off the giggle factor. The impact made headlines across the world. In 1998, two blockbuster films, Deep Impact and Armageddon, explored how the people of Earth might respond to a huge approaching asteroid. Scientists commended Deep Impact for its understanding of the impact threat and the realism of its special effects, which reflected the input of a fleet of technical advisors that included Gene Shoemaker, whom the comet Shoemaker-Levy was named after. Armageddon, in contrast, was described by Clark Chapman as scientifically and technologically preposterous in almost every respect. Due to increasing interest from the public and advocacy from scientists, in 1998, Congress tasked NASA with finding 90% of all near-Earth asteroids and comets larger than 1 kilometer within a decade. The effort would, with due acknowledgement to Arthur C. Clarke, be called Space Guard. Space Guard has been a huge success. We have now tracked 93% of asteroids larger than 1 kilometer and found more than 98% of the extinction-threatening asteroids, which measure at least 10 kilometers across. Prior to Space Guard, the estimated risk that Earth would be hit by an extinction-level asteroid was around 1 in 200 million per year, we now know that the risk is less than 1 in 15 billion, 100 times lower. The last two chapters discuss ways that we can make the future better, for however long civilization lasts. This chapter and the next two will look at ways we can ensure that we have a future at all, beginning with risks of the near-term extinction of our species. SpaceGuard showed that we have what it takes to manage risks to the extinction of humanity, if we put our mind to it. Though we discovered that there was no imminent threat from asteroids, the tracking meant that if we had discovered an asteroid on course to collide with Earth, we could have devoted enormous resources to deflecting it and to building food stockpiles in case we failed. A few hundreds of millions of dollars was enough to appropriately manage this risk. But in the coming decades, we will have to deal with much greater risks. If we do not rise to the challenge, there is a decent chance that humanity could come to a premature end and our future could be destroyed. Engineered pathogens. Most of this book was written during the COVID-19 pandemic. At the time of writing, COVID-19 is estimated to have caused 17 million excess deaths worldwide, one in every 500 people. The death toll is sure to increase in the future. The economic cost will amount to more than $10 trillion. And billions of people have lived under lockdown for months on end, unable to see their family and friends in person, even when dying in hospital. But despite the toll of COVID-19, in some respects, we've gotten off easily. We know that viruses like Ebola can be deadlier than the new coronavirus, and some, like the measles, can be more transmissible. If the new coronavirus had been 10 times as deadly, then the death toll could have amounted to hundreds of millions or more. Looking to the future, the threat posed by pandemics may be much greater still. This greater threat comes not from naturally arising pathogens, but from diseases that we ourselves will design, using the tools of biotechnology. Biotechnology is an area of research that tries to build new biological entities or alter those already found in nature. Progress in this field has been extremely rapid. We typically think Moore's law, halving the cost of computing power every few years, is the prime example of quick progress. But many technologies in synthetic biology actually improved faster than that. For example, the first time we sequenced the human genome, it cost hundreds of millions of dollars to do so. Just 20 years later, sequencing a full human genome costs around $1,000. A similar story is true for the cost to synthesize single-strand DNA, as well as the cost of gene editing. This rapid technological progress promises great benefits in medicine and in the treatment of rare genetic diseases, but it also brings unprecedented risks, in particular because it gives us the power to design and create new pathogens. Engineered pathogens could be much more destructive than natural pathogens because they can be modified to have dangerous new properties. Could someone design a pathogen with maximum destructive power? Something with the lethality of Ebola and the contagiousness of measles? Thankfully, with current technology, this would be at least very difficult. But given the rate of progress in this area, it's only a matter of time. Not only is biotechnology rapidly improving, it is becoming increasingly democratized. The genetic recipe for smallpox is already freely available online. In a sense, we were lucky with nuclear weapons insofar as fissile material is incredibly hard to manufacture. The capability to do so is therefore limited to governments, and it is comparatively easy for outside observers to tell whether a country has a nuclear weapons program. This is not so for engineered pathogens. In principle, with continued technological progress, viruses could be designed and produced with at-home kits. In the future, cost and skill barriers are likely to decline. Moreover, in the past, we only had to deal with one pandemic at a time, and usually some people had natural immunity. In contrast, if it's possible to engineer one type of new, highly destructive pathogen, then it's not that much harder to manufacture hundreds more, nor is it difficult to distribute them in thousands of locations around the world at once. Since the techniques of biological engineering are becoming ever more powerful and ever more democratized, one would hope that there would be a commensurate improvement in caution and safety around this research. We would expect laboratories doing this research to have extremely high safety standards and the research to be very strictly regulated, with severe punishment for any lapses in safety. But in fact, the level of biosafety around the world is truly shocking. For example, I remember as a teenager seeing images on the news of giant pyres burning thousands of cow carcasses. This was reporting of the 2001 UK outbreak of foot and mouth disease, an infection affecting hooved animals that causes a high fever and painful blisters in the mouth and feet, and sometimes leads to lameness and death. The outbreak originated with pigs that were fed garbage containing the remains of illegally imported meat contaminated with the disease, and it spread to over 2,000 farms across the UK. Before it was finally contained, the outbreak led to the culling of millions of sheep and cattle and cost a total of £8 billion. After it was contained, enormous effort went into making sure it did not happen again. Government reports were written, laws were changed. But just 6 years later, there was another foot and mouth outbreak. Unlike the 2001 outbreak, the 2007 outbreak started with a leak from a lab that was developing vaccines to protect livestock against foot and mouth disease. Some of the pipes carrying waste from the lab to the facility's waste treatment were old and leaky, and waste contaminated with a disease leaked out into the soil and eventually reached a nearby farm. The poor maintenance of these pipes constituted a clear violation of the lab's license to work with an infectious pathogen. While this outbreak was caught and contained within weeks, it never should have happened in the first place. So, after this disaster, surely the utmost precautions were taken to prevent the risks of a foot and mouth outbreak happening again, right? Sadly, no. Soon after the containment of that 2007 outbreak, there was a third outbreak, just a few weeks later, from the very same lab. The lab had failed to comply with the government's conditions for resumption of their vaccine production, and once again leaked foot and mouth into the environment. These are not isolated events. In fact, uncontrolled pathogen escapes are almost commonplace. In one of the deadliest confirmed lab leaks on record, over 100 people died after being exposed to anthrax 836, the most powerful strain of anthrax in the Soviet bioweapons program, in April 1979. A technician in a covert anthrax drying plant in the city of Sverdlovsk removed a clogged filter without replacing it. He scribbled a note for his supervisor, but forgot to record it in the logbook. His supervisor didn't find the note and started up the plant. And anthrax escaped through the filterless vent and was carried to nearby buildings by the wind. In another instance, in 1971, a woman on an environmental research ship in the Aral Sea was exposed to a strain of smallpox that was probably used in a nearby bioweapon field test. The strain had been designed to be highly virulent and possibly vaccine resistant, and it was aerosolized so that it could travel across large distances. While she was still asymptomatic, she returned to her home city of Aralsk, where 9 others subsequently became infected, including a woman and 2 children who then died. Soviet officials locked Aralsk down, incinerated several properties, and vaccinated the entire population of 50,000 people, preventing a larger outbreak of one of the deadliest viruses in the world, but perhaps only narrowly. Similarly, smallpox leaked from virology labs not once but 3 times in the UK during the 1960s and 1970s. A mild strain infected a medical photographer working above an unsafe virology lab at the University of Birmingham in 1966, leading to 72 confirmed cases. In 1973, a lab technician at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine became infected with smallpox and was then placed in an open ward where he infected 2 people visiting a patient in an adjacent bed. The 2 visitors' infections were fatal. In fact, the last person to ever die from smallpox, Janet Parker, who died in 1978, was a medical photographer working above the very same Birmingham lab that had caused the 1966 outbreak. And between 1979 and 2009, there were 444 infections in labs permitted to work with especially dangerous pathogens. The accidents were caused by a mix of human error and equipment failures and involved diseases like Ebola, anthrax, Rift Valley fever, and encephalitis. Even if it becomes possible to build pathogens that are far more destructive than foot and mouth or COVID-19, surely no one would want to do so. After all, bioweapons seem useless for warfare because it's extremely difficult to target who is infected. If you create a virus to decimate the opposing side, it's likely that the pandemic will invade your home country too. One can think up counterarguments. Perhaps, for example, the country deploying the bioweapons would first vaccinate its population against them. Perhaps, as a deterrent, the country would create an automated system guaranteed to release such pathogens in the event of a nuclear attack. But the stronger argument is that, as a matter of fact, major bioweapons programs have been run. In the past, the United States, Japan, and the Soviet Union all had major bioweapons programs. The Soviets was the most extensive by far, lasting 64 years and employing as many as 60,000 personnel at its height. They built entire cities, not found on any map and not accessible to foreigners, where they did all of their bioweapons research. While most other countries' bioweapons programs were limited in both their scope and success, the Soviet program managed to develop a wide range of bioweapons which could assassinate individuals, kill crops, and even incapacitate people across large areas, though these weapons were not operationally useful. The program was highly secretive. While the USSR claimed to have shut down its bioweapons program in 1972 when it signed the Biological Weapons Convention, it continued running it until the collapse of the Soviet Union. In fact, it is unclear whether Russia has ever completely dismantled the Soviet program. The program was not known to the United States until the Russians voluntarily disclosed information about it in 1991, though it had been suspected earlier because of defector accounts and the anthrax outbreak at Sverdlovsk. Even if such weapons are never used in warfare in the future, they could still leak from the labs where they are developed. The list of lab escapes I discussed before only includes those that have been confirmed. The true number is probably much higher. Data on infections that have happened in US labs that work with relatively dangerous pathogens indicate that for every year that 250 full-time employees are working in these labs, there has been one accidental infection. If we assume that the Soviet bioweapons program saw accidental infections at the same rate as US labs, then we should expect that there were thousands of lab escape infections from the Soviet program. And that assumes the Cold War era Soviet bioweapons program was as cautious as the post-Cold War US biomedical community. Instead, it was probably much riskier. Given the lengths the Soviet Union went to keep their bioweapons program secret, it seems possible that they kept thousands of accidental lab infections secret as well. After all, they managed to conceal the outbreaks from their bioweapons programs in Sverdlovsk and Aralsk. Supporting this theory are cases where there is at least some evidence that disease outbreaks thought to have come about naturally may have actually been the result of human error. For example, there is now some evidence, based on genetic analysis, that the 1977 Russian flu pandemic, which according to one estimate killed 700,000 people, may have either leaked from a lab or resulted from a poorly implemented vaccine trial. I think it is difficult to rule out the possibility that synthetic biology could threaten human extinction. One could try to approach this problem by anticipating specific ways novel technology could be misused. However, in doing so, one would need to carefully balance the risk mitigation benefits of improved foresight against the risks of lab accidents and inspiring bad actors. There is some precedent for the latter. For example, starting in 1927, Major Shiro Ishii spent years lobbying the reluctant Japanese Ministry of War to pursue a bioweapons program. He learned about the power of bioweapons after reading about them in a Japanese physician's report on the 1925 Geneva Disarmament Conference, a convention whose key purpose was to garner support for the ban on chemical and biological weapons. He successfully convinced the Japanese military to pursue a bioweapons program, arguing that biological warfare must be worth pursuing, Otherwise, it would not have been outlawed by the League of Nations. Now infamous for its extensive experimentation on human subjects, the Japanese bioweapons program existed for 11 years and grew to employ a few thousand personnel. Similarly, the man who conceived of Al-Qaeda's bioweapons program, Ayman al-Zawahiri, wrote that he had only become aware of the destructive power after the enemy drew our attention to them by repeatedly expressing concern that they can be produced simply. After they invaded Afghanistan, the United States found books and journal papers relevant to building bioweapons and plans for a bioweapons lab in an Al-Qaeda training camp near Kandahar. The documents also showed that an Al-Qaeda operative with doctoral training in microbiology had tried to acquire bioweapons and vaccines for workers at the planned laboratory. By sounding the alarm bell, we risk making it more likely that such a catastrophe could occur. Yet for risk mitigation, it is important to understand which dangers to our future loom largest. Many extinction risk specialists consider engineered pandemics the second most likely cause of our demise this century, just behind artificial intelligence. At the time of writing, the community forecasting platform Metaculus puts the probability of an engineered pandemic killing at least 95% of people by 2100 at 0.6%. Experts I know typically put the probability of an extinction-level engineered pandemic this century at around 1%. In his book, The Precipice, my colleague Toby Ord puts the probability at 3%. Even if you dispute the precise numbers, I think that in no way can we rule out such a possibility. And even if the probability is low, it is still high enough that preventing such a catastrophe should be a key priority of our time. Imagine you are stepping aboard a plane and you were told that it had only a 1 in 1,000 chance of crashing and killing everyone on board. Would you feel reassured? Only once a huge comet collided with a nearby planet, creating a fireball that reached more than 30,000 degrees Celsius, did governments and the wider public turn their attention towards the risks from asteroids and comets. It is tragic that it might take something as disastrous as COVID-19 to convince the world to pay more attention to pandemics. And the COVID-19 pandemic is tame in comparison with the horrors that novel engineered pathogens might bring. The world eventually got its act together on asteroids and comets. It is time we did the same for engineered pathogens. People in the long-termist community were warning about pandemics for many years prior to COVID-19. One of the main long-termist funders, Open Philanthropy, was one of the few pre-COVID funders of pandemic preparedness in the world. It made its first grant in the area in 2015 and has since given out more than $100 million in the area. The group 80,000 Hours has recommended careers in pandemic preparedness since 2016. In 2017, I had dinner with Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, and was given the opportunity to pitch her on one policy. I chose pandemic preparedness, focusing on worst-case pandemics. Everyone laughed, and the host of the dinner, Sir Tom Hunter, joked that I was freaking everyone out. Great Power War. The greatest driver of engineered pathogens so far was undoubtedly the Cold War. In the hunt for military superiority, the Soviets pursued a bioweapons program that achieved nothing except the deaths of dozens of Russians and the exposure of millions more to the risk of a horrific death. Simply put, when people are at war or fear war, they do stupid things. Wars are tragic no matter where and when they happen, but especially concerning from a long-termist perspective are those that pit the most powerful countries of their time, the great powers, against each other. This is simply because of the sheer scale of destructiveness required to cause human extinction or other irrecoverable harms to future generations. An all-out war between the world's largest and most technologically advanced militaries is more likely to exceed that grim threshold than more limited conflicts. Long-termists may thus be tempted to rejoice in the observation that soldiers from the great powers haven't met in battle since the end of World War II. This long peace might suggest that great power wars are a relic of the past, or at least much less likely today. Unfortunately, I don't think we can take the long peace for granted. As I revise this chapter for publication, Russia's invasion of Ukraine reminds us that war can all too quickly return to regions that have enjoyed peace for decades, and that initially more limited disputes can push the world's largest nuclear powers dangerously close to the brink of a direct confrontation. And there are several reasons to think that the risk of great power war in the next 100 years remains unacceptably high. First, it seems plausible that maintaining the long peace has involved a healthy dose of luck in addition to structural factors like economic growth and international cooperation. We know that the United States and the Soviet Union came close to war during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. But this was hardly the Cold War's only moment of danger. Tensions were also high during the Berlin Crisis, the Suez Crisis, the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, multiple crises in the Taiwan Strait, and proxy wars in Korea and Vietnam, as well as on several occasions when early warning systems failed and sent false alarms of incoming nuclear attacks. World War II has been characterized, in part, as hugely unlucky due to Hitler's unlikely rise. But the peace that followed has also been partly the result of chance. Second, changes in the distribution of global economic and military power may increase the risk of conflict. China is on track to surpass the United States on a number of dimensions. Indeed, after adjusting for purchasing power, China's economy is already larger than the United States. Power transition periods, when one superpower nation surpasses another, appear to be especially unstable times as rival powers compete for influence over the international system. While war is far from inevitable at such times, and many past power transitions have been peaceful, several scholarly analyses have found that the proportion of transitions that do turn violent is worryingly high. Many different factors contribute to the decision to go to war, but disagreement over relative status and distribution of political, economic, and military power within the international system can play important roles. Alliance commitments can draw distant countries into regional disputes. Powerful countries and countries that have long-standing rivalries are more likely to fight than other countries. The United States and China are poised to be the most powerful countries by far in the coming decade, but there are significant risks of war between other great powers too. Russia maintains an enormous arsenal of nuclear warheads, and the US-Russia relationship has deteriorated. India is projected to be the most populous country in the world by 2030 and could overtake China as the world's largest economy of this century. There are also significant military tensions between India and China. While writing this book, I read the news about the Galwan Valley clash on June 15, 2020, a violent skirmish between Indian and Chinese soldiers in territory high in the Himalayan mountains that is claimed by both countries. The two countries had made agreements not to use firearms along the disputed border. So instead, they attacked each other with stones, clubs, and batons wrapped in barbed wire. More than 20 people died. One report suggested that ties between both countries had reached their lowest point since the 1962 Sino-Indian War. To be clear, war between great powers this century is not inevitable. For one, power transitions do not inexorably end in conflict. In the 20th century, the United States surpassed Great Britain, and the Soviet Union became a major force in Eurasia, without these countries coming into direct conflict with each other. And the US-China relationship, at least, lacks some of the characteristics of the most dangerous kind of international rivalry. In particular, the countries do not share a border or claim any of the same territory, two powerful factors that push countries towards war. Their economies are also entwined, as each is currently among the other's largest trading partners, which some researchers think makes war more costly and hence less likely. Finally, if the last 70 years of peace have been the result of systemic, enduring changes to the way countries relate to each other, then peace may continue. Perhaps a nuclear war would be so destructive for everyone involved that it's not worth taking any actions that risk causing one. Some scholars also think that the prospect of deploying nuclear weapons seems so wrong that their use has become taboo. Following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the community forecasting platform Metaculus more than doubled its predicted chance of a third world war by 2050 to 23%. defining a world war as one involving countries representing either 30% of GDP or 50% of world population, and killing at least 10 million people. If that annual risk stayed the same for the following 50 years, this would mean another world war before the end of the century is more likely than not. What makes this especially troubling is that growing military spending and new technologies are increasing humanity's capacity to wage war. If the great powers came to blows in the future, they could deploy weapons far more destructive and lethal than those used in World War II. The potential for devastation is enormous. Just as smoking increases the risk of practically all forms of cancer, great power war also increases the risk of a host of other risks to civilization. First, it diverts spending away from things that improve the safety and quality of life. And second, it destroys our ability to cooperate. The Cold War led the Soviet Union to the insanity of a secret bioweapons program. A new conflict between the major powers would increase the temptation to develop new biological weapons of mass destruction. Even if it didn't lead to direct violent conflict, a new Cold War could also increase the risk of an AI arms race, and so increase the risk of bad value lock-in or misaligned AI takeover. It would increase the risk that nuclear weapons are used, and it would undermine our ability to cooperate internationally to deal with climate change. In my view, reducing the likelihood and severity of the next world war is one of the most important ways we can safeguard civilization this century. Would a technologically capable species re-evolve? For human extinction to be of great long-term importance, it needs to be highly persistent, significant, and contingent. Its persistence might seem obvious. If we go extinct, we can't come back from that. But there's a counterargument one could make. Even if the end of Homo sapiens is highly persistent, perhaps the end of morally valuable civilization is not. That is, perhaps if Homo sapiens went extinct, some other technologically capable species would evolve and take our place. The last common ancestor of humans and chimps was alive only 12 million years ago, and it took only around 200 million years for humans to evolve from the first mammals. And there are still at least hundreds of millions of years remaining until the sun's increasing brightness renders the Earth uninhabitable to human-sized animals. Given this, if Homo sapiens went extinct and chimps survived, shouldn't we expect a technologically capable species to evolve from chimps, like Planet of the Apes, in 8 million years or less? Similarly, even if all primates went extinct, as long as some mammals survived, shouldn't we expect a technologically capable species to evolve within around 200 million years? This is a long time, but it's still easily short enough for such evolution to occur before the Earth is no longer habitable. This argument is too quick. We don't know how unlikely the major evolutionary transitions were, and there is reason to believe that some of them, including potentially the evolution of a technologically capable species, were very unlikely indeed. There are two reasons to think this. The first is based on the Fermi paradox, the paradox that, even though there are at least hundreds of millions of rocky, habitable zone planets in the galaxy, and even though our galaxy is 13.5 billion years old, giving ample time for an interstellar civilization to spread widely across it, we see no evidence of alien life. If the galaxy is so vast and so old, why is it not teeming with aliens? One answer is that something about our evolutionary history was exceptionally unlikely to occur. Perhaps planets that are conducive for life are in fact extremely rare, perhaps needing to be in a safe zone in the galaxy with plate tectonics, a large moon, and the right chemical composition. Or certain steps on the path from the formation of the Earth 4.5 billion years ago to the evolution of Homo sapiens were extraordinarily unlikely. Potentially extremely improbable steps include the creation of the first replicators from inorganic matter, the evolution of simple cells into complex cells with a nucleus and mitochondria, the evolution of sexual reproduction, and possibly even the evolution of a species, like Homo sapiens, that is distinct from other primates by virtue of being unusually intelligent, hypercooperative, culturally evolving, and capable of speech and language. Recent research by my colleagues at the Future of Humanity Institute suggests that once we properly account for uncertainty about just how unlikely these evolutionary transitions might be, it actually becomes not all that surprising that the universe is empty, even though it is so vast. The second reason to think that one or more of the evolutionary transitions in our past were very unlikely is how long it took for Homo sapiens to evolve. Consider this. Suppose that, for an Earth-like planet, it should take, on average, a trillion years from the planet's cooling to the evolution of a species capable of building civilization. If this were true, what would we expect to see in our past? Well, we would expect it to look almost exactly the way our actual past does. We would have evolved fairly close to the end of the habitable lifetime of the Earth. Because there are only around 5 billion years from the cooling of the Earth to the end of the period over which it could sustain life, there's no way in which we could have evolved except by being extraordinarily lucky. Because we would see the same timescales of evolutionary history, whether the transition from an Earth-like planet to a technologically capable species ought to have taken 5 billion years or a trillion years, we just can't infer how likely or unlikely that transition was. We don't currently know how many extremely unlikely evolutionary transitions there were in our past. Some research suggests that we should expect there to have been between 3 and 9 hard steps on the path to the evolution of advanced life. But there has only been very limited investigation of this question, and the true number could well be higher or lower. And we don't know how unlikely it was that biological evolution would produce a species that was capable of building civilization, even after mammals or primates had evolved. For all we currently know, the evolutionary step from mammals to a species capable of building civilization could have been astronomically unlikely to occur. We therefore cannot be confident that, were human civilization to end, some other technologically capable species would eventually take our place. And even if you think that there is a 90% chance that this would happen, that would only reduce the risk that a major catastrophe would bring about the permanent end of civilization by a factor of 10. The risk would still be more than great enough that reducing it should be a pressing moral priority. Moreover, if some step in our evolutionary history was extremely improbable, there might be no other highly intelligent life elsewhere in the affectable universe, and there might never be. If this is true, then our actions are of cosmic significance. With great rarity comes great responsibility. For 13 billion years, there was no known consciousness. There was no entity such that, to borrow a phrase from Thomas Nagel, it was like something to be them. Around 500 million years ago, that changed, and the first conscious creatures evolved, the spark of new flame. But those creatures were not conscious of being conscious. They did not know their place in the universe, and they could not begin to understand it. And then, merely a few thousand years ago, over the little more than 1/10,000,000th of the lifespan of the universe so far, we developed writing and mathematics, and we began to inquire about the nature of reality. Now, and in the coming centuries, we face threats that could kill us all. And if we mess this up, we mess it up forever. The universe's self-understanding might be permanently lost, and within just a few 100,000,000 years more, the brief and slender flame of consciousness that flickered for a while would be extinguished forever. The universe might return eternally to the state it occupied for much of its first 13 billion years. Cold, empty, dead. Extinction is not the only way in which civilization might come to an end. Perhaps instead some disaster falls short of killing everyone, but causes civilization to collapse and we never recover. I'll turn to that possibility next.